From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Ray Suarez, and this is On Point. We have a busy week ahead, from the summit with North Korea to the GOP's inner battle over immigration to Trump on the campaign trail. But we can't talk about what's next without looking at where we are after the extraordinary theatrics around the G7 summit this past weekend. The president and his men have stepped onto the world stage with their rhetorical fists flying.
There's a special place in hell for any foreign leader that engages in bad faith diplomacy with President Donald J. Trump and then tries to stab him in the back on the way out the door.
That was White House trade advisor Peter Navarro on Fox News yesterday, laying into Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. And that's just for starters. This hour on Point, top reporters open their notebooks for us and look at the week ahead. You can join us on air or online. Tell us what you make of the G7 summit. What will you be looking for when Trump and North Korea's Kim sit down to talk in a matter of hours? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now from Washington are Nahal Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent at Politico. Nahal, great to have you with us.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Jeff Pegues also is with us. He's justice and homeland security correspondent for CBS News. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray.
And finally, Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time. Molly, great to talk to you again.
Hi, Ray. Great to be here.
Here was Canada's prime minister at the conclusion of the G7 summit in Quebec on Saturday, saying Canada had no choice coming out of the summit but to retaliate against its most important ally and trading partner, the U.S.
We move forward with retaliatory measures on July 1st. I have made it very clear to the president that it is not something we relish doing, but it is something that we absolutely will do, because Canadians were polite, we're reasonable, but we also will not be pushed around.
Here was Larry Kudlow, director of the president's National Economic Council on CNN's State of the Union, pretty much pounding his fist and saying this president won't be pushed around.
POTUS is not going to let a Canadian prime minister push him around, push him, POTUS, around President Trump on the eve of this. He is not going to permit any show of weakness on the trip to negotiate with North Korea, nor should he.
So this was about North Korea?
Of course it was, in large part.
Hallie Tusi, these things might be the kind of things that are said behind closed doors at the G7, but dishonest and weak, stab in the back, special place in hell, is it odd to hear them said publicly?
Very much so. And I'm not sure that at the G7, even behind doors, you would hear that kind of language. I mean, this is supposed to be a group of allies, people who get along, people who believe in the rules-based international order, an order that the United States helped set up. So the notion that they are fighting and that they are squabbling in public is really, really astonishing. And, you know, Trump says, or his advisor says, that he doesn't want to look weak before going to meet the North Korean leader. But the reality is that in many ways, Trump provoked this fight with his allies in the G7 with his tariffs and other means. And so he's going into this summit in a fight with his own allies. And that does not help him look strong either.
It was surprisingly intemperate, Molly Ball. I mean, even one aide mocking Justin Trudeau, saying that he was a big, tough guy once he got back on his plane.
I don't know that any level of intemperance is surprising from this president and the administration backing him up. But you certainly could not get a starker split screen of the uniqueness of the Trump foreign policy than, you know, on the one side, Trump feuding with Canada, of all places, in extremely aggressive terms, and then and insulting the leader of Canada. And then on the other side, making nice with the North Koreans and flattering the dictator of that brutal regime in advance of the summit that'll happen tonight, U.S. time.
And Jeff Pegues, also during this consequential international meeting, calling for Russia to be let back in the club. Now, that would be a political decision rather than an economic one. Let's remember Russia's economy is about the same size as Australia's or Spain's, not a big player on the international stage economically.
Yeah, and that was the big slap in the face before he even got to Canada, that he would bring up Russia and discuss perhaps including Russia in the G7 again. That was another insult to the people there, the leaders there gathering for the G7. And so, you know, right from the start, that summit did not get off to a positive start. You have those G7 countries who obviously decided that they did not want Russia in the G7 because of its invasion of Crimea. And so you're right. That was another puzzling move by President Trump ahead of that summit, which, of course, went downhill from there.
Now, to look at this with a little even-handedness, people who take the Trump point of view say that this was really the G7 was really an outfit that was picking America's pocket, that was not advantageous for the United States to be a part of under the current rules, and that even though this was an American initiative, it wasn't really working for the United States anymore. This is widely reported on one side of the ledger, Hallie Toosey.
Right. But I mean, it depends on how you look at it. Certainly in some parts of trade, other countries in the G7 might run surpluses with the United States. But as a whole, the U.S. runs surpluses on a number of levels and generally benefits from this system. I mean, it's strange to have the president of the United States complaining about this trade issue right now and saying people are hurting when you have an economy with basically a record low unemployment rate. You know, it's booming in a lot of ways. And so it's this strange, discordant note that's coming out from the Trump administration. And frankly, a lot of Republicans are deeply, deeply upset with the president's policies on trade, which, you know, are policies and ideas he has held for decades. It's one of the rare areas where he's relatively consistent on anything. But yet many people will say he simply does not understand the details and that his ideas are outdated, if not flat out wrong.
We heard Larry Kudlow earlier relating the outcome of the G7 to the upcoming talks with the North Korean leader. Right now, running on the New York Times website, the headline, "Clash with Canada Isolates Trump Ahead of Kim Meeting." Jeff Pegues, I'm not sure what the two have to do with each other. Is Kim Jong-un paying attention to Donald Trump's relationship with Justin Trudeau?
Well, I think the world is, because it says a lot about his view of the world, his view of the traditional U.S. allies versus the traditional U.S. adversaries. And that's why this is important. If you look at this issue beyond trade, you know, the G7 is made up of allies that the U.S. Works with on intelligence matters as well. And then whenever there's a conflict in the world, often we go to those allies for support. You know, obviously that happened in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so this is bigger than trade. These are the traditional allies that the U.S. has relied on, of course, for more than a century. Depending on what relationship you're talking about. So this is important. And there's really, you know, depending on what side you're on, whether Republican or Democrat, it's hard to normalize this and this now standoff with Canada, which is so unusual because we rely on the Canadians. They rely on us. This has been a mutually beneficial relationship over decades.
And Molly Ball, from the Trump point of view, there would have had to be a compliant G7 in order to send him well on his way to Singapore. I'm not sure how the calculus works here.
Well, it was very interesting because shortly before he departed for the summit in Canada, Trump was asked about his preparations for the Kim summit, and he said he wasn't doing a lot of traditional preparation. And those who have covered this administration certainly know that that's the case, that this president doesn't have a lot of time for things like briefing books and long lectures from experts. He said that he felt that it was his personality and his business experience that had sort of prepared him. So when when he was saying that this G7 summit was going to be a distraction, I think he meant that it was going to distract him. And indeed, it did seem like he was so fixated on this conflict with the Canadians, with less than 24 hours before, the first meeting of an American president face-to-face with Kim Jong-un, he's still tweeting his rage against Justin Trudeau. As you pointed out, the Trump administration does believe that there is a method to this, that they are proponents of a sort of stark realism, right? That the United States needs to look out for its own interests. When we go to meetings with other countries, we're not there to hold hands and sing kumbaya. If there's nothing in it for us, we're not there to moralize or send a message. It's about what's best for America. And so that, I think, was what Larry Kudlow was talking about when he said, this is just about doing business with Russia. It's not about whether we approve or disapprove. But the results of that have been, as Jeff was saying, very strange for anyone who's followed traditional American foreign policy.
Sean writes on Facebook, by pulling out of the Paris Accords and the nuclear deal with Iran, Trump sent a message that America will not keep its word, at least not while Trump is president. I'm sure that's not what he intended to do, but whether he intended it or not is not the issue. The trust is eroded anyway. From our website, Gregors writes, he thought Trudeau was an easy mark, mistook politeness for weakness. Now he's going to escalate. Canada is probably in for a rough ride. We're looking back and looking ahead to the news of the coming week, from the president's performance on the international stage to the immigration bill, a big Supreme Court decision may soon be here, and more. You can join the conversation. What do you make of the new indictments against the president's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort? Minnesotans, North Dakotans, are you getting your MAGA caps ready for the president's campaign stops this week? I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.
The news can feel like an echo chamber. You listen to podcasts to get that perspective shift. So travel with NPR's Rough Translation. Follow familiar conversations in unfamiliar parts of the world and get a new perspective on home. Rough Translation. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. We're looking at the week to come after the extraordinary weekend we just witnessed. Where are we now, do you think, as arguably two of the world's most unconventional heads of state meet in Singapore and perhaps get an assist from Dennis Rodman to talk nukes? What news stories will you be focused on? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests are Nihal Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent at Politico, CBS News justice and homeland security correspondent Jeff Pegues, and Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time. Here was the new Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, in Singapore today, hours away from the face-to-face meeting between President Trump and North Korea's Kim Jong-un, saying, we've done our homework, we know what we're doing, and we know what we want out of the talks.
Any suggestion that the United States somehow lacks the technical expertise across government or lacks it on the ground here in Singapore is mistaken. North Korea has previously confirmed to us its willingness to denuclearize, and we are eager to see if those words prove sincere.
Is this the coming out party, Jeff Pegues, for the Pompeo-Bolton tag team?
Well, it looks like the Secretary of State has taken the lead here. I think John Bolton upset the North Koreans a few weeks ago with some of his statements comparing the regime and potential goals in this planned summit at that time to what happened in Libya. And so it looks like Secretary of State Pompeo has been leading the charge here and the discussions. But what has happened now, it sounds like from the latest information from the White House, that this summit is moving more quickly than expected, which is an interesting statement. They're not revealing exactly what that means, whether there's been some sort of breakthrough that's going to speed things up, or whether the president is simply becoming impatient with being away from Washington. We'll have to see. But it looks like at this point, right, that it is Secretary of State Pompeo who's leading the discussions there at this point.
Hallie Tusi, I think Jeff is right about raising expectations out of one side of their mouths, but also dampening them at the same time. It depends, I think, on which statement you see.
Correct. Pompeo often is responding to criticisms that are out there, cautions that people are raising, saying, for instance, look, you don't have a bunch of nuclear technical experts with you. Are you sure you know what you're doing? And of course, he has to, strike a positive pose. He cannot exude anything other than confidence. But that being said, Pompeo is really kind of out on a limb. If this all falls apart, or if this meeting goes more quickly, as the White House puts it, which could suggest that they're realizing there's not a lot of common ground and they don't want to drag this scene out. If this goes that way and nothing comes of it, then Pompeo is the one who's going to shoulder a lot of the blame. And so by that measure, you could think, well, John Bolton, who has been very hawkish on North Korea for many years, could come out of this looking pretty good, saying, hey, see, I told you so. They're never going to play along. And we need to talk about other options.
As Molly reminded us before the break, a reporter asked how long it would take Donald Trump for him to know whether North Korea's leader is serious about denuclearization. And the president said,
"That's a good question. How long would it take? I think within the first minute, I'll know.
How?
Just my touch, my feel. That's what I do."
Colfax, Wisconsin is our first stop. Willem, welcome to the program.
Hi. I hope these discussions lead to a fruitful an outcome, but I don't trust the president. I think his comment about just my touch, just my feel, this is all he has, is his grandiose view of himself. His history as a businessman is pretty bad, and I'm always reminded by David Brooks's comment that everyone that's associated with Trump is diminished by Trump, and I'm afraid that's true of our country, so I don't have much confidence. He doesn't prepare for this because of his he's so smart, he's so intelligent, he knows everything. He doesn't behave like a normal diplomat or a normal president. So I think he has already diminished our country in the standing of the world. He seems to be more friendly toward Putin than to our closest neighbor in Canada. So, this president is deeply disturbing. So I don't have much hope for a good outcome.
Willem, thanks a lot for your call. Appleton, Wisconsin is next. Mark, welcome to the program.
Hi, I was calling about the immigration.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that one reason we have so much trouble is that we're not operating under the Constitution. I mean, the House is working under the Hastert rule, which means you have to have a majority of Republicans before anything passed, which means you don't need bipartisanship, and you also don't get anything done, which is why, I mean, we had an immigration bill in 2013. The House wouldn't pass it, again, because of this Hastert rule. It's something I don't think gets given enough attention. Same as the filibuster in the Senate, which is 60 votes, which, again, is not in the Constitution and just slows everything up. I mean, it just blocks everything.
I think you're right about the framers giving you a puzzled look if you mention the Hastert rule. But the Hastert rule is a political idea, Mark, isn't it? The idea that you need a majority of the majority caucus, not overwhelming support, not the kind of thing that we see lately where the entire Democratic caucus votes against something and the entire Republican caucus votes for something, but you do need a majority of the majority to have the oomph to move forward. But you're not buying that.
Well, it just seems to me that blocks a lot of things. And it seems it gives them, the Freedom Caucus, these 40 votes, an enormous amount of power. It's a tiny minority in the country, and yet they're able to block everything. And then look at the effects on the country, the fact that we don't have a comprehensive immigration bill that would provide security and deal with DACA and deal with the 11 million undocumented. And we're stuck in this awful place now, which brought in Trump.
Molly Ball, this immigration debate has really divided the Republican majority in the House, hasn't it?
Yes, and that has been the case for many years. But there is another procedural quirk that I'm sure the caller is also referring to that does allow a way around these obstacles that he's talking about, and that is what is happening among the House Republicans right now is the attempt to rally enough Republicans and Democrats behind what's called a discharge petition, which forces the congressional leadership to hold votes on something, short-circuiting the traditional or the usual prerogative of the speaker to decide what legislation does and doesn't come to the floor. But it has been the case since 2013, when the Senate passed a comprehensive immigration bill with 65 votes, that there were enough votes in the House and Senate to pass a comprehensive immigration bill if the bill could go to the floor. I think that calculus may have changed since 2016, given the amount of mileage that Trump got out of the immigration issue, which has really pushed his own party, pushed Republicans in a more negative direction. But there are the leaders of this discharge petition are Republican, moderate Republicans in swing districts who really feel perhaps they would say a moral imperative, but a political imperative to show their constituents that they are fighting on this issue. And it's not just we talk a lot about Hispanic voters, but it's also the business community, particularly with the unemployment rate so low. You have a lot of businesses crying out for workers and saying, if we don't increase immigration, there's just no way we can do things like, you know, run farms and factories.
They're conscious of the approaching midterm elections. Does the fact that the speaker will cease to be a member of the House of Representatives on January 1st help things along? Is he willing to be take riskier moves, stick his neck out politically, Molly Ball?
So far, no, but we'll see. The deadline for this action, I believe, is tomorrow, Tuesday. And right now, what's been happening is the proponents of the discharge petition have been negotiating. All of the House Republicans have been negotiating to see if they can find some common ground. I don't think there exists common ground between the extreme positions here, particularly between, you know, the hard right that wants to decrease overall immigration levels and deport everybody, and the moderates who want to liberalize immigration. But that's what Paul Ryan, the, as you say, outgoing speaker, is trying to broker right now. It's anybody's guess. The other thing that we don't really know about this discharge petition movement is whether it was more of a negotiating tactic to begin with, or whether they're serious about really calling the speaker's bluff if he doesn't get there.
Also coming in the days to come, more breaking news from the Mueller investigation. Jeff Pegues, we saw more charges laid against Paul Manafort, the former Trump campaign manager, and a Russian associate. Does the charging document give us some interesting things to chew over about how Mueller has penetrated the communications of Paul Manafort and his associates?
Well, obviously, they are keeping tabs on him, and despite having the reality of facing all of these charges, according to the investigators, Mueller continues to reach out to former associates and, in the view of the special counsel, obstruct justice, tamper with witnesses, and that's what this case on Friday is all about. Manafort is currently under house arrest. He's got a $10 million unsecured bail. But of course, given what happened last week when the special counsel came out and essentially said that Manafort and one of his associates, Konstantin Kalimnik, who is overseas, have been trying to tamper with witnesses, the special counsel is moving to have his bail revoked. And so that's what this hearing on Friday is all about. We'll see what comes out of that. But obviously, the problems for Paul Manafort, the president's former campaign chairman, continue to mount. Every week, it seems, there is some new revelation that, according to the special counsel's office, seems to put Manafort in more mounting jeopardy. And so you have this superseding indictment that was revealed on Friday, heading into this court hearing this coming Friday. So there is a lot at stake for Paul Manafort here. Once again, the problems for him continue to mount.
Hallie Tusey, let's be clear. Konstantin Kilimnik is not in Brighton Beach in Brooklyn having a glass of tea waiting for federal agents to pick him up. Why charge these Russians? What's going on? What should people understand about what the Mueller world is up to in naming these Russians, detailing their activities, pulling them into the ambit of the investigation?
Oh, man, you're asking me to read Bob Mueller's mind, and that would be great. I mean, to be honest, I'm one of those people who's eagerly awaiting the ultimate Mueller reports. I feel like I'll read them like a, you know, eagerly like a really bad romance novel. And it'll be just fascinating. But look, I think one piece of the strategy is to lay out a bunch of dots that ultimately can yield some sort of a picture. And I think to some extent, they're still trying to figure out the team itself. The Mueller team is still trying to figure out exactly who knew what when about each of these pieces. If they are still pursuing a collusion scheme, then they have to know who all the players are, and they have to know at how much of a web that they wove. But there's also so much along the way about the obstruction of justice aspect that's coming out that it increasingly seems like that's going to be the stronger route that they're going to take. But this is just—it's just really fascinating to watch.
And you have no particular insight to share with people from coast to coast about when you might see that document, do you?
I'm sure once it comes out, it'll be like number one on Amazon or whatever. Not that they're going to sell it, probably, but I mean, it probably should be. So they can make a lot of money.
A bestseller in the waiting. Well, you know, that's happened before with high stakes, high profile federal reports like that of the 9/11 Commission, which was an instant bestseller. I'm sure in some ways these what comes out of the Mueller investigation will be no different, avidly and eagerly read.
I think the 9/11 Commission was actually nominated for some sort of an award, too. So, yeah, it was.
Jeff, were you trying to get in there?
Yeah, you know, and I should have mentioned this. Konstantin Galimnik he's a rather significant name who has sort of flown under the radar for the last year and a half. But those of us who've been following this story really from the beginning, we've been tracking him because he is important in all of this, only because he is Manafort's point man in Ukraine and in Moscow, essentially. He is someone who has known ties to Russian intelligence. And this is something that our intelligence and law enforcement sources have been telling us for quite some time now, and we've done some digging into his past. And that's why he is important. The fact that his name comes up now in this indictment, I think, is significant, because if there is any sort of coordination between Manafort and perhaps some Russian operatives, it would occur through Konstantin Kostya Kalimnik. And so that's why he is an important name in all of this. And you're right. When this document that Mueller delivers, when it finally comes out, it will be interesting reading. And part of that will focus, obviously, in large part on Manafort and his activities.
Jay writes, okay, Molly, I'm sorry.
I was just going to point out, this is sort of a technicality, but in our cover story about the investigation in Time last week, we looked at a lot of the technicalities of this process. According to the special counsel regulation, this isn't something that would be, published in book form or as a public report. The special counsel is to report his findings to the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein. And then it's up to Rosenstein what to do with that report and whether to forward it to Congress and whether to then make it public. And surely he'd be under a lot of pressure to do so. But
it is conceivable and legal for him to sit on it?
That's correct.
That would drive people crazy.
Well, given the amount of leaks overall in every step of this process, it's hard to imagine it staying under wraps. But that is technically possible.
From our website, NSTEF writes, Trump's handlers don't want him to look weak before his meeting with Kim Jong-un. But from a negotiating standpoint, everything Trump does makes him look weak. Much of what he does is textbook whining. Jay writes from Twitter, Donald Trump acts like the U.S. is the sun in the global economic solar system, and we are not. The rest of the world will work around us. It will hurt our economy. Is this what a trade war looks like? Well, it should be remembered that this president's formative years were at a time when the United States was the sun and the rest of the world revolved around it. It's a far more diverse, far better distributed global economy these days. The United States is rich, but so are a lot of other places. We're talking with reporters about the stories they'll be watching as the week unfolds. Join the conversation. Are there issues, news stories important to you that are being drowned out by all the dramatics on the international stage? The unfolding campaign, healthcare, immigration. I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We do long-form interviews with the people behind the best books, pop culture, journalism, and more, so you can get to know the people whose work you love. You'll find Fresh Air on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. We're looking at the week ahead with Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time, Nahal Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent at Politico, and Jeff Pegues, Justice and Homeland Security correspondent for CBS, and with you, of course. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Molly Ball, our explosive tweets and provocative photographs from La Malbaie, Quebec, obscuring the results and the shape of the primary season and what's going on as we get ready to have midterm elections.
Well, as a political reporter, I am never too busy to follow the primaries. But it does seem like they've been less of a story this year than is often the case, in part, as you mentioned, because of the perpetual noise machine that is the presidency. But also, I think there just hasn't been as much seeming conflict. For the past 8 years, I feel like I've been covering the Republican Civil War, and we've had these very contentious primaries between Tea Party and establishment Republicans. The Republican Party is still in an identity crisis, perhaps now more than ever, but that dynamic has changed and Trump has disrupted it. On the Democratic side, you absolutely have a party that's been, thrown into chaos by the unexpected loss in 2016, also going through an identity crisis, trying to find its ideological moorings and some kind of leadership to bring it out of the wilderness. But these primaries, again, have been somewhat low-key affairs. And in terms of, what Democratic voters want out of their party, do they want the Bernie Sanders wing? Do they want a sort of more moderate face? It really hasn't been clear. You've had results go both ways and not a clear thread emerging, except women are winning in Democratic primaries really disproportionately. An analyst for the Cook Political Report, Dave Wasserman, looked at all the situations in Democratic primaries where there was a woman candidate, a man candidate, and no incumbent. And women won 70% of those contests on the Democratic side. On the Republican side, only 38% of the same situation. So it's really just in Democratic primaries that voters are looking to women to be the face of the party going into November.
Are those women who are winning those races all over the place across the Democratic spectrum, or do they represent one part of the Democratic tendency in 2018?
They are really all over the place. You've had some of them be the progressive candidate in the race and some of them not. But what has been consistent, another thing that we've seen with many of these women candidates, and I should clarify that the Wasserman statistic is only looking at House of Representatives races, but it has been broadly true up and down the ballot. But a lot of these women also are political newcomers because the 2016 election inspired this wave of women's activism. A lot of liberal women called it a sort of wake-up call, and we had the Women's March and so on. That activism has not abated. The organizing continues to occur across the country. And so a lot of these women were doing something else. They were teachers. They were professors. I guess that's also a teacher. They were lawyers. They were fighter pilots. They were something. And a lot of them have now gotten into politics for the first time because the 2016 election spurred a sense of urgency about changing the face of politics.
This broke just in the last few minutes. The Supreme Court is allowing Ohio to clean up its voting rolls by targeting people who haven't cast ballots in a while. the justices are rejecting by a 5-4 vote Monday arguments that the practice violates a federal law intended to increase the ranks of registered voters. A handful of other states also use voters' inactivity to trigger a process that could lead to their removal from the voter rolls. Justice Samuel Alito says that Ohio is complying with the 1993 National Voter Registration Act, and in the vote, he was joined, in the majority opinion, by his 4 conservative colleagues. So if you've ever asked yourself whether having Neil Gorsuch instead of Merrick Garland was consequential, this may be one of those moments. Molly Ball, Ohio also a purple state.
Yeah, and this is a very contentious decision already. You're seeing a lot of commentary from opponents of the decision saying that it amounts to voter suppression. One thing that a lot of people don't know is that there is no affirmative right to vote in this country. That's part of the reason that things like voter registration are done on a state-by-state basis. There isn't something in the Constitution that sets out everybody's right to vote. And so you have different states doing different things, and you know, there's voter ID and other tactics potentially limiting people's ability to vote that have been widespread in recent years. And this has really become a major, as you point out, partisan battle between the parties who view it as in their advantage or not to try to and I should also say that proponents of this decision say that this is about eliminating voter fraud and making sure that people who aren't real voters or who perhaps have died do not remain on the voter rolls, linger there when they're no longer eligible to be voters, which they say opens the door to them being impersonated or fraud being committed.
Hayes, Virginia is our next stop. Margaret, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray.
Hi.
I have concerns about the immigration situation with the children being separated from their parents. I feel what most Americans miss is most of these people are escaping extreme brutality and therefore willing to take the risk. Young boys in particular have been frequently snatched out of school by the cartel, brutalized, tortured, and fed drugs to, you know, participate in their drug dealing. So I wish we would have more compassion. These are not jihadists, and we have no moral ground to stand on with the rest of the world when we're doing this.
Jeff Pegues?
Well, that's one of these hot-button issues that the White House has taken on and the Department of Homeland Security has taken on. Obviously, the Trump administration has been talking quite a bit about this plan to separate families who crossed the border illegally. Kirstjen Nielsen, the Homeland Security Secretary, is asked repeatedly about this, and she defends the policy, saying essentially anyone who breaks any other law, and they come from families, obviously they will be separated too, so we are just following the law. But it's one of those issues that in some quarters, obviously, has become problematic for this administration as it tries to defend this policy. And on the front lines of that is the DHS secretary.
Senator Dianne Feinstein is challenging the Department of Justice and Department of Homeland Security policy here, trying to push back against zero tolerance with a bill she wants to introduce. Hallie Tusi, is this getting a lot of attention, I wonder, in Mexico and Central America? Is this being followed closely? Are these countries that are the sending countries in many cases aware of what's happening to their nationals when they reach the United States?
Well, it's certainly getting a lot of attention in the Latin American press, but I think that that's actually part of the White House's strategy. John Kelly, who used to be the DHS secretary and is now the chief of staff for President Trump, said months and months ago that he was thinking about taking children away from their parents when these families reach the border. And he made it clear, and they have since, that this is supposed to be a deterrent effect. They want the news to get out there so that people don't come to the United States because they don't want to be separated separated from their children. But that being said, you know, if you are an asylum seeker and you feel like you face certain death if you stay in El Salvador or whatever it is that you're trying to escape, the idea that you might be separated from your child for a while, as traumatic as it might be, still, you know, might not be enough to keep you from trying to find safe haven in the United States. And at the very least, what we're seeing is the United States take these kids away from their parents, even when these people are seeking asylum. And seeking asylum under international law is something that people are allowed to do. Asylum seekers are not supposed to be treated as criminals the way that the DHS and ICE and the DOJ are treating these people right now. And this is something that, honestly, I think in the future you're going to see the United Nations and other organizations that do human rights reports and other things raise this as a major, major blot on the United States' record.
Columbia, Missouri is next. Sue, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. Thank you for letting me in. I'm calling about a little tidbit that I read the other day that I haven't heard much discussion of, and that is that apparently the Justice Department is going to stop enforcing that part of the ACA that requires the insurance companies to provide coverage for people with pre-existing conditions. And it's just another list in the parade of horribles that are coming out of this administration. And my question is, are they going to be able to get away with this? Is there anybody in Congress who is stepping up and who plans to do something? Is there any movement at all?
Sue, it's a great question. And interesting, in a midterm election year where that's one of the most popular parts of the Affordable Care Act. Molly Ball?
That's right. This stems from a long-shot lawsuit, I believe, out of Texas. As you probably remember, the Supreme Court previously declared most of the Affordable Care Act constitutional, but this lawsuit is attacking that mandate on pre-existing conditions, and where the Obama administration previously defended the health care law against lawsuits like this, the Trump administration saying, we will not defend the law because we agree with the lawsuit that this provision is not valid. Health care has been, as you say, the top issue of people who've gone to the polls so far this year and in surveys of the electorate. And this is the kind of thing that really worries vulnerable Republicans. The Republicans are already concerned that they stand to lose the House in November. The only question is by how much. Pushing a hot button of the healthcare issue, going up against the most popular part of the health care bill, is something they're very worried about. I think this immigration issue is something they're really worried about, too. You have a lot of Republican strategists saying, you know, in these particularly the sort of affluent, educated suburban districts that many vulnerable Republicans represent, these pictures of children being ripped from their parents at the border is not a good look. And they're very concerned that the politics of that are not going to end well for them. Because as the caller, implied, the remedy for this is political. If people don't like it, they can vote to change who's in Washington.
As the Republican Party was getting ready to fight the 2016 election season, they assured voters that, yes, they recognized that parts of the Affordable Care Act were very popular, and they hoped that they could keep the parts that people like and get rid of the parts that they don't. And the timing may be unfortunate on this for some members of Congress, as Molly Ball suggests. Our last task for this hour is to hear from our reporters on what they'll be watching and what they want you to be looking out for in the coming days. Hallie Tusey?
Well, obviously, I'll be watching North Korea and the fallout from the G7. But another thing that is really on my radar screen is what's happening in Yemen. There is an imminent attack by the United Arab Emirates and its allies, which the U.S. is supporting on a port city known as Hodeidah. And this port city is basically where 80% to 90% of humanitarian supplies and other things are going into Yemen, which this is a country that's been in a state of war for a few years now, and millions of people are on the brink of famine, basically. And the United Nations has urged the Emirates, the Saudis, and others not to launch this attack. They have said hundreds of thousands of people could die if this ends up being a siege that ends up capturing the city from Houthi rebels that are backed by Iran. And the United States, which has largely backed the UAE and the Saudis and others on this front, has basically just giving a yellow light. They're not saying at this point, don't do this attack. They're urging the Emiratis and others to try to engage in the UN-backed peace process for Yemen. But they're not saying, don't do this, don't do this. We're not going to help you. And it looks like this attack is going to go ahead. And already you have humanitarian organizations and others pulling out of Hodeidah, which means that the Yemeni people are going to be getting even less help.
Jeff Pegues, what do you have your eye on?
Well, obviously, the fallout from the G7 summit, I think that will continue through the week. But also what is happening in Mesa, Arizona. You had video released last week of these officers in surveillance footage punching and kneeing an unarmed man. Five officers involved in that have been placed on leave. There was another case last week where a teenager, in the eyes of some of the people who've seen the videotape in that arrest, say that it was excessive force used in that case. So a couple of investigations in the Mesa, Arizona Police Department. I think that's important because that is a department that in the past has faced use of force accusations. And so even though they've had these issues in the past, for some reason, they continue to surface. So that's a case that that I'm interested in seeing what happens this week.
And Molly Boyle, you have about 40 seconds. Wow, she's stunned. I guess we lost Molly somewhere along the way. I want you all to be paying close attention to the news this week. This is going to be a big one. Sanders writes, these leaders have no choice but to respond. There are politics at home for them, too. Trump doesn't get that or just plays politics for his base. Marion writes, just when everybody realized Macbeth was both evil and mad in Act 3, the fun was just beginning. Two more acts to go. Nahal Tusi is foreign affairs correspondent at Politico. Nahal, great to have you with us. CBS News' Justice and Homeland Security correspondent, Jeff Pegues. We always love hearing from you, too. Jeff, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Ray.
And you can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bowman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Imada, Stefano Kotsonis, Allison Poli, Jeremy Relosa, James Ross, Grace Tatter, Gretchen Voss, and Miriam Wasser, with help from Carolyn Anders. The executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.